The money moves first, quietly, confidently. A Miami gallery offers work said to be by Andy Warhol. Bright colors, familiar forms. The price tags climb fast. Collectors are told the pieces are real, vetted, cleared. Questions are waved away with calm voices and official-sounding reassurances. The checks clear. The total passes more than $6 million. Then the doubts start. A buyer asks who authenticated the art. A name is given. A phone number follows. Emails arrive on letterhead that looks right. The answers feel firm. Too firm. Behind the scenes, investigators will later allege those contacts were not real at all, that voices belonged to impersonators, that institutions were copied, not consulted. What looks like confidence begins to feel like theater. And the moment trust cracks, the entire market around these works starts to wobble. Chapter 1, The Sale Before the Doubt. The gallery sat in Miami, light, clean, and confident. White walls, controlled silence. Art that felt familiar at first glance. Bright colors, repeated forms, faces and symbols that carried weight before anyone asked a question. These works were presented as Andy Warhol's, not studies, not tributes. Originals, rare, market-ready. The man selling them was Leslie Roberts. To buyers, he came across as calm and practiced. He spoke in the language collectors expected. Provenance. Private sales, quiet placements. He did not push, he reassured. He framed the opportunity as limited and time-sensitive without sounding desperate. Collectors listened. Some had bought blue-chip art before. Others relied on advisors. The works were offered at prices that signaled legitimacy. Not bargains. Not absurd reaches. Just high enough to fit the Warhol market at the time. A few million dollars spread across multiple transactions. By the end, the total would climb past $6 million. Nothing about the process felt rushed on the surface. Buyers were told the works had been vetted, that questions about authenticity had already been handled, that paperwork existed and could be reviewed. The tone was steady, professional. This was not a street deal. This was a gallery sale. Money moved first. Wire transfers cleared. Checks were deposited. Ownership was transferred. Art changed hands before any buyer contacted a major Warhol authentication body directly. That was not unusual in private art sales. Trust often filled the gaps where formal verification lagged behind. In the art world, trust functions like currency. Dealers trade on reputation. Collectors lean on relationships. When the numbers are high, confidence becomes part of the product. Buyers are often told that too many questions can kill a deal. That insisting on outside review can offend sellers or cause works to disappear into other collections. In this case, the assurances seemed sufficient. Buyers were told that any concerns had already been addressed, that the works were known, that the seller had done this before. No alarm sounded at the moment of sale. The cracks appeared later, quietly. One buyer asked a follow-up question weeks after closing. Another wanted a name, not a gallery reference, an institution, someone official. The response came quickly. A contact was provided. The voice on the phone sounded confident. Emails arrived that appeared professional. The language mirrored the tone of established foundations. At this stage, there was still no accusation. No one claimed fraud. The questions were cautious. Routine. But something felt off. The answers were polished. Too immediate. There was no delay. No internal review. No paperwork sent for independent inspection. The responses seemed designed to end the conversation. Behind the scenes, doubt began to build. Collectors compared notes privately, advisors whispered. Provenance documents were reread. Small inconsistencies surfaced, dates that did not quite line up, ownership chains that felt thin. But none of this was yet conclusive. What mattered most was timing. The sales had already happened, the money was gone, the art was hanging on walls or stored in climate-controlled vaults. At that point, suspicion did not equal proof. And in the art market, suspicion alone rarely triggers action. Roberts continued operating as before. There was no public indication of trouble. The gallery remained open. No warnings were issued. To the outside world, nothing had changed. What buyers did not know at the time was that investigators would later focus heavily on this early phase, not the impersonation, not the alleged fake institutions, but the moment when money moved before verification, that gap. That pause where trust replaced proof. According to later allegations, this window was essential. Once funds were transferred, leverage shifted. Questions became harder to press. Disputes became slower. Art law is complex. Jurisdiction matters. Burden of proof matters. The longer a buyer waits, the murkier recovery becomes. At this stage in the story, none of that was visible. Buyers believed they had purchased legitimate Warhols. Roberts maintained that position. There were no retractions, no refunds, no acknowledgments of error. The art itself remained central. Familiar imagery carried authority. Warhol's market history gave the works a kind of built-in credibility. Collectors had seen similar pieces sell publicly. Museums displayed related works. Auction houses printed glossy catalogs. Nothing about the art screamed fake to the untrained eye. And that is where the pressure sat. Between what buyers thought they knew and what they had not independently confirmed. Between the confidence of the sale and the quiet unease that followed. This chapter is not about exposure. Not yet. It is about sequence. About how quickly legitimacy can be constructed when price, presentation, and tone align. About how the absence of immediate resistance can allow a sale to finalize before scrutiny begins. By the time doubts hardened into questions, the structure of the deal was already in place. The art had a paper trail. The seller had been paid. Any challenge would now require evidence, not instinct. The central question at the end of this phase was simple and unresolved. Who had actually verified these works, and why had no one insisted on hearing directly from them before the money moved? That question would not stay quiet for long. 2. Authentication theater. The questions did not arrive all at once. They came in pieces, a call here, an email there, a buyer asking for a name, an advisor asking for a process. Each request sounded reasonable. None accused anyone of wrongdoing. They were framed as routine follow-ups, due diligence after the fact. The answers came fast, too fast. Buyers were directed to individuals described as connect to Warhol institutions. Foundations, archives, authorities that carried weight in the art world. The implication was clear. These works had already passed through the right hands. Any lingering concern could be put to rest with a phone call or an email. Those calls were made. The voices on the other end sounded confident, professional, familiar with the language of authentication. They spoke about catalog numbers, provenance reviews, internal records. Nothing felt improvised. Nothing felt uncertain. The goal seemed to be closure, not conversation. Emails followed the same pattern, clean formatting, formal tone, institutional phrasing. They arrived quickly, sometimes within hours. There was no sense of delay or internal debate. Questions were answered directly. Doubts were smoothed over. The message was consistent. These works were legitimate. For a moment, that worked. But authentication in the high-end art market usually moves slowly. Requests are logged, files are reviewed, opinions are issued cautiously, if at all. Foundations protect their authority by limiting access. They do not rush. They do not reassure casually. Some buyers noticed the difference. An advisor flagged the speed. Another questioned why responses came from individuals rather than official channels. A collector asked for documentation that could be independently verified. The replies remained calm, but the substance stayed thin. No physical inspection was arranged. No formal letters were issued on verifiable institutional letterhead. The process felt complete without ever becoming concrete. Behind the scenes, suspicion hardened. What buyers did not know at the time was that investigators would later allege this entire layer was fabricated. Not mistaken. Not sloppy. Built. According to the allegations, fake foundation contacts were created to serve a single purpose, to reassure buyers long enough to stop deeper scrutiny. Phone numbers allegedly routed to impersonators, email addresses allegedly designed to mimic legitimate institutional domains, voices trained to sound authoritative, language chosen to mirror real authentication correspondence. This was not a one-off lie, it was theater. The effect was psychological as much as practical. Buyers wanted certainty. They wanted to believe. The presence of an apparent authority provided an exit from doubt. Once reassured, pressing further felt unnecessary, even impolite. Some collectors backed off their questions, others delayed action. The moment passed. Outside experts who later reviewed the case would point to this phase as the hinge, not the sale itself, not the art alone, but the deliberate construction of credibility through impersonation. It was here that suspicion could have turned into exposure, and here that it was neutralized. The art market is especially vulnerable to this kind of manipulation. Authentication is fragmented. No single body controls verification. Foundations vary in their policies. Some no longer authenticate at all. Others operate quietly. That ambiguity creates space for mimicry. According to the allegations, that space was exploited. As doubts persisted, buyers began comparing notes more directly. What one person was told matched what another heard. Same reassurances, same phrasing, same tone. At first, that consistency felt comforting. Later, it felt rehearsed. A few collectors sought independent opinions. Private experts reviewed images. Some raised red flags, stylistic inconsistencies, materials that did not align with known Warhol practices, provenance gaps that felt too wide to ignore. These were not definitive conclusions, but they deepened concern. At this stage, the issue was no longer abstract. The question was not whether something felt wrong, it was whether the authentication process itself was real. That question triggered escalation. According to later filings, law enforcement attention sharpened once impersonation was suspected. Institutions whose names had been invoked were contacted directly. They denied involvement. They denied issuing opinions. They denied recognizing the contacts buyers had been given. That denial mattered. It transformed uncertainty into allegation. What had been presented as institutional authority now appeared to be imitation. What had sounded official now appeared scripted. The very speed that once reassured buyers became evidence of fabrication. Investigators would later allege that the fake authentication layer was not a side detail. It was central. Without it, the sales would have collapsed under scrutiny. With it, the illusion held just long enough. This was the moment the narrative changed. The issue was no longer just forged art. It was the deliberate impersonation of trust itself. Institutions were not merely bypassed, they were copied. Their credibility was weaponized. For buyers, the realization landed hard. They had not just been sold questionable art. They had been guided away from the truth by voices designed to stop them from asking the right questions. The pressure shifted. What had been private concern became formal inquiry. Lawyers became involved, complaints were drafted, evidence was gathered. The tone changed from cautious to adversarial. And still publicly, nothing had happened yet. There were no headlines, no arrests, no courtroom scenes, just documents moving quietly. Interviews conducted carefully, a case taking shape out of emails, call logs, and institutional denials. This chapter is about control, about how confidence can be manufactured, about how authority can be simulated convincingly enough to delay accountability. By the time the alleged impersonation was fully understood, the damage was already done. The art was sold. The money had moved. Trust had been spent. What remained was a question that could no longer be answered privately. If the authenticators were not real, who built them? Chapter 3. Exposure and fallout. The shift from suspicion to allegation happened quietly. There was no dramatic raid, no public warning, just a series of confirmations that did not match the story buyers had been told. Institutions whose names had been invoked were contacted directly. Their responses were brief. They had no record of the works, no record of the contacts, no record of providing authentication. That gap mattered. Once investigators understood that institutional identities may have been mimicked, the focus tightened. The issue was no longer a dispute between collectors and a gallery. It became a question of whether a coordinated deception had been built and maintained across multiple transactions. Federal investigators began mapping communications, email headers, call routing, timelines. They traced how buyers were funneled towards supposed experts and how those experts responded with consistency and speed. According to the allegations, the same small network appeared repeatedly, always positioned between doubt and resolution. The alleged scheme took shape through documentation rather than confession. Emails that looked official but did not originate where they claimed. Phone numbers that did not connect to real institutions. Patterns that suggested planning rather than coincidence. At the center of the allegations was a simple claim that forged works attributed to Andy Warhol were sold using fabricated authentication channels designed to neutralize scrutiny long enough for money to change hands. Charges followed. Not artistic disputes, criminal allegations tied to wire fraud and financial deception. The filings focused on conduct, not opinion, on impersonation, not taste, on money moved under false pretenses. In court documents, investigators laid out a narrative that stretched from the gallery floor to the inboxes of collectors, a narrative that argued intent, that the misrepresentation was not accidental, that it required coordination, that it relied on impersonation of authority. The art itself remained important, but it was no longer the main character. The process was, how trust was built, how it was maintained, how it was allegedly exploited. For the art market, the impact rippled outward. Dealers whispered, collectors reviewed past purchases, advisors revisited files. The case exposed a familiar vulnerability, that private sales rely heavily on reputation and assumed legitimacy, that authentication is fragmented, that institutions are powerful symbols even when they are not directly involved. Victims face limited options. Art recovery is complex. Resale is difficult once authenticity is questioned. Insurance claims hinge on fine print. Litigation takes time. Even when fraud is alleged, restitution is not guaranteed. Some collectors absorbed the loss quietly. Others pursued legal remedies. Reputations were affected on all sides. Buyers worried about being seen as careless. Advisors worried about missed signals. The gallery world tightened inward. The alleged impersonation of institutions struck a nerve. Foundations and archives issued clarifications. Some reiterated that they do not authenticate privately. Others emphasized official channels. The message was defensive, protective. Authority had been borrowed without permission. As the case progressed, the public learned what insiders already knew, that the art market's reliance on informal trust creates openings, that confidence can be manufactured, that documentation can be simulated convincingly enough to pass casual inspection. The fallout extended beyond money. It reshaped how collectors asked questions. Independent verification became more common. Direct institutional contact became standard. Delays were accepted where speed had once been prized. Still, the damage could not be undone. The alleged victims were left with works they could not confidently display or sell. Objects that once carried prestige now carried doubt. The emotional toll matched the financial one. Trust once broken does not reset easily. For the accused, the process became public and permanent. Allegations were now part of the record. The quiet certainty of the gallery gave way to scrutiny. Every past transaction was reconsidered, every assurance reevaluated. This chapter is not about resolution in the clean sense. Legal outcomes take time, appeals exist, facts are tested in court, allegations remain allegations until proven. But the exposure itself carried weight. It revealed how easily authority can be imitated when systems are opaque, how quickly reassurance can replace verification, how pressure to close a deal can override caution even among experienced buyers. The final question is not whether fraud can occur in the art market. That answer is already known. The question is whether the systems that allowed it will change. In this case, trust was not just misplaced, it was allegedly engineered, and once that became visible, the illusion collapsed. What remained was a warning written in documents and losses rather than headlines. When institutions can be copied, belief becomes the most valuable commodity of all.